organization has enabled us to rapidly increase the pace of innovation and bring innovations to the enterprise. Many times it was a 36-month cycle from the time you originated an idea to the first time you had that idea in a customer's hands and being used in on-premise in the enterprise communications environment. Consumerization of IT, we see now new code being written, loaded into a web SaaS environment, and users using it within days, within weeks. And we believe, as part of our strategy, we have to enable that same level of rapid development processes and then pushing those capabilities out to our customers as quickly as possible. And the web and cloud-connected capabilities is the way that we see doing that. And then I talked earlier a little bit about leveraging the install base of what's been deployed, the assets that have been deployed on the premise so far. We can't throw those away. We can't start over. That's just not rational. It's not logical. And we believe at Cisco that there is a lot of value of fusing together the assets that are on-prem and with the new experiences and new capabilities from the cloud to deliver a very rich, meaningful experience that is easy to use, and the end user experience is at the very center of our focus. I walked through these already, each of the tenets to the strategy, so I'm just going to keep moving in the interest of time. I talked a little bit about this journey before, and the fact that we all started with enterprise telephony systems, and there was a data network as well, and the data team was, you know, in a CIO's organization, the only place the data team and the telephony team ever talked was at the CIO's office. We started to see that change very quickly with voice over IP, and then very quickly came the advent of video. And so that telephony experience and the data networking group started to come together. And then we had web conferencing. Then we had mobility with soft clients. And we came out with a product called Jabber that came across your desk phone that then was able to load on whether it be iPads, iPhones, PCs, and have your exact same desk phone experience with voice, video, and messaging in a mobile environment, in a soft client environment. Hosted collaboration, we brought those experiences to the cloud so that customers had choice and they could consume these experiences either on-prem in their own network or as a service through a partner. And then we started to bring additional capabilities through our own cloud with WebEx, telepresence, and cloud-connected audio. In terms of where we're at in the journey and what's coming up next, we're on the, number three, if you will, work anywhere, right? We've had network convergence. We've had the breadth of experiences start to come together. And we're in the mobility era, if you will. We're advancing the mobile and borderless experience, but we still have a ways to go around fusing together the capabilities from the cloud and the on-premise environment, and then we still have to get to what we call contextual collaboration, and it's going to be here before we know it. A couple of use case examples that I'll just leave you with before I turn it over to my colleague. Contextual collaboration should be better than being there. Why can't I, in the middle of the beginning of a conference, where I'm on WebEx or on an audio conference, bring up the people's names in the window and click on somebody's name? Maybe I remember Mr. Rawlings, but I just can't remember when I met him or when the last interaction was. And I should be able to click on his name and all the IMs, instant messaging, communication we've done come up in a file, all the recent emails come up, anything that's on the public internet in terms of a Facebook or LinkedIn or Twitter profile come up, and I should have all that information exposed to me very, very quickly and succinctly so that I understand who I'm talking to, who I'm engaging with in this conference. Have you ever been in a conference where you say, wait, can you stop? Can you go back a slide? There was something on that slide I missed. Can you go back a slide? Why should I have to do that? Why can't I have DVR-like functionality where I personally scroll back on the slide absorb what I missed, and then play it forward without having to interrupt the rest of the conference. These are examples in, you know, highly used use cases that we're using in developing our contextual collaboration capabilities, infusing all of these capabilities together with what we have today on-prem and what we can deliver from the cloud to make this truly a user-centric, easy to use, intuitive, and contextual set of interactions to change the way we work today. Over to you.
Okay, thank you very much, Eric. Our next speaker, Ian Kalin, comes to us for representing Socrata, and Socrata is the technology provider partner that we use for our open data portal. So Ian has some very deep experience in the area of open data, big data, and so forth. So Ian?
Thank you, Bill. Thank you all. Good afternoon. It is a great privilege and honor to have this opportunity to speak with you all today, entertain and do my best to answer your questions. I'll also say it's a privilege to be joined by two such extraordinary world-class companies, AT&T and Cisco. It's an honor to even be on the same table with me along such brilliant organizations. You've probably never heard of my company because we're quite a bit smaller than my colleagues here to my left. I'll give an introduction as to what we do and why I'm so passionate about it. I'll start with a very brief bio. I'll start my professional career. I was in the Navy, counterterrorism, nuclear engineer. Had the privilege of transitioning that military experience into a clean tech entrepreneur startup. Did quite a bit of work in Dallas with a company you may have heard of called Mesa Power, and a bit of wind turbines that never went anywhere. But it was my opportunity to learn a bit about how Texas does business. From those many power plants that I helped construct, I had the privilege of serving the White House with the President's technology team. I'm the first Presidential Innovation Fellow, leading a number of the national open data initiatives. From that work, had a few other quick tours and landed at a little startup company based out of Seattle called Socrata. Our mission is to unleash the value of data to help the world around us. And so I would say that in this context, we're very excited to have been graduated from a pilot with Dallas about a year ago into an operational deployer, a partner in terms of helping your government achieve its transparency and a few of its technology goals. So what I want to do is talk a bit about how this stuff works. Okay, so Cisco, AT&T, fantastic, inspirational, fun videos, I gotta say. I love the music of at least two of them. In terms of what data can do from the data generated within those companies and by citizens, where I fit in is how to leverage and liberate the value of the data you generate that's generated by City Hall. And so I'll look at the connected cars as an example. You know, I love those videos, and maybe I heard whispers of maybe it was creepy, maybe it was cool, maybe somebody said, shut up, I'm trying to drive. Mm-hmm. Right, all those, I would say, even in that example, where's the data coming from? What parking spaces are available if they're owned by the city? What exactly is the legal business permit? What's the population of that city? What about some of the locations of the rec and park services? Where are those city parks? All that information is actually generated by you. It's generated by the government. You have that data. And right now, actually, you're publishing quite a bit of it. And so what we do at Socrata is we provide that middle layer. We're the connector. There was a slide before I couldn't help but take advantage of. I thought about preparing some slides, I'll say, but then I saw that I was the third presenter, and I said, yeah, an hour in, I'm just going to go with a few stories. So I hope you don't mind if I leverage some of the previous images. Socrata is not the enterprise layer. We're not the applications. We're the enabler. We allow you as governments to liberate your data so that you can take from these extraordinary foundations and infrastructure, architecture provided by the AT&T and Cisco, connect it with people, connect it with businesses, so that they can solve some of those problems like, wow, I forgot my wife's birthday, or how am I going to find the next parking space, or even at different levels of the services that you provide. How am I going to get a reminder about my unemployment benefits? How am I going to figure out if I'm going to get the right reimbursement for my school voucher? It's not just the high tech. Sometimes it's beyond tech. It's folks trying to engage with this business of government we call services. Some people need a lot of help. Some people need a lot of help from government. Some people, not that much. Either way, at any end of the spectrum, they're still taking information from government. And so there has to be a better way to inform those people. So here's the fun part about this business of government. As we've seen today, citizen expectations are rising. It's easy for us to buy something on Amazon. It's easy for us to make a phone call and to get information, get navigation from our smartphones. Are we seeing that type of innovation from all governments? I think it's fair to say that most governments are trying to catch up. Not good, not bad, it's just the reality of the situation. A lot of governments are trying to innovate in the same way that businesses have, and now the citizens are demanding it. And I'm actually very, very glad, and I have to give credit to, in my own experience, you know, Bill talked about benchmarking, Dallas is actually doing a great job. You can pay for a parking ticket online. You can. It works. Not that I know personally, but I did a little test this morning. It's actually not, I did my piece of contributing to the Dallas economy. You have a 311 system. Talk about citizen engagement. I'm sure you're all very familiar with the 311 platform that Bill has led. But in case you have not looked at it recently, some of the most important concerns of your citizens are litter, high weeds, loose animals, violent animals, nonviolent loose animals, and just general debris. So your citizens are very concerned about the cleanliness of your city, concerned about the safety of your city. They don't like those dogs. Sorry? Loose animal problem. It may or may not be. It's on your website. It's... Okay. Well, so you know what? You're familiar with it. That's fantastic. I'll tell you what. You know what? I got to save a benchmark. I have the privilege of working with hundreds of governments throughout the world. Most of those folks don't even look at the 311, don't even know what their citizens are saying. Dallas is doing very well in engaging its citizenry. You're hearing what the people are concerned about. And with this thing called open government, the way technology can be an enabler, it allows for a two-way conversation. That's what Socrata is about. We are powering your open data portal. And by the way, open data portal, it may sound like a fancy technology term. This concept is not new. Open data is not new. It's as old as the very first library in human civilization. It's about public resources, getting our data, our information out there to inform our citizenry so they can make better decisions and live, work, and play better, right? So the technology enabler is it's changing the way in which citizens engage with those people, less of a one-way conversation. The government needs to just give money, not ask questions afterwards. Just give services and not figure out where those folks are going. The 311 system is great. It's a great example of how you can have a two-way conversation. And for those of you, of course, with private sector experience, surveys are common in the private sector, not as easy to do in government unless you consider elections and taxes part of that survey. So from a regular perspective, an everyday perspective, how do you bring information to people where they're making the decisions that they need? How do you get information into the hands of the person at the airport, at the school, at the parent-teacher meeting, at the town hall? Socrata provides a platform for that. It is a cloud-hosted software as a service. It allows you to publish your content, to manage your privacy controls, and to provide a platform where everyday folks can figure out things like where's the closest, we'll say business, I'm looking for school boundaries, social services, healthcare facilities, to things like restaurant inspection data or crime data. This is the type of information that you're generating with or without technology. You all would be in this business if we never showed up. But how do you find a way to liberate that data, extract the value from that information so people can do something with it? That's that middle layer that I'm talking about, and that's where Socrata fits in. So what I'll do in just a few more minutes is I'll give some examples of how this stuff is working, and particularly giving credit to the foundation of success that Dallas has led, but also with a bit of fairness, if you can afford me, I'll talk a bit about where I believe Dallas can go in terms of improving that citizen engagement, improving the quality of that service. So we'll start with how people live. So you all have a bunch of housing data. You're a city. You have building inspection. You have zoning laws. You have safety inspection in terms of whether or not something is licensed as a business, whether this house has rodents. I had a chance to go through some of that information, and lo and behold, you're all publishing it. Well, you look at businesses like Trulia, like Zillow, some of the platforms that people use to buy a home, to live that American dream and get that house. Well, you know, a lot of the data that people use to make those decisions aren't actually in sites like Trulia or Zillow, because a lot of governments aren't publishing that data in a format that can be consumed. There was a previous point about open APIs, what's called application programming interfaces. It's basically the contracts that technical folks can use to automatically synchronize data between silos, breaking down those firewalls where data is stored. Well, lo and behold, with your open data portal, companies like Trulia and Zillow can consume that information and embed it into their profiles. So if I wanted to buy a house in Dallas, I can figure out if it has bad foundations that have been cited by the city 10 years ago, or whether if I'm renting from an abusive landlord, lo and behold, that information is within your city hall. It's just not getting to the people when they need to make those decisions. I talked about the connected cars, the parking spots. You know, there's actually a great example. I think it's actually powered by AT&T. In San Francisco, those are public. It's publicly owned land, city parking spots, city-charged parking rates. How do you feed that information? I can pay electronically. Is that going to a system where folks who want to be able to take their connected car, or any car for that matter, and find where there is available parking downtown during a busy day or during rush hour? How do you know where those spots are? That data, again, can be liberated from City Hall and given to people in the connected car or walking down the street when they're trying to figure out how to be able to just do business downtown. In terms of how people work, you know, the fun part about open data is that it's not just about transparency. It's not just about being accountable and giving information back to the taxpayers. Sometimes it's about, most of the times it's about job creation. Megabytes can lead to jobs. Public data can create jobs. And the fun part about it is it is happening all across the country. Just last week, Wall Street Journal had a great article basically profiling a bunch of businesses that are fueled by open data. Open data is today what copper was in the Industrial Revolution. It's a fuel. You put it out in its raw form, and yeah, it may be a little dirty, but there are some fantastically innovative businesses that are taking this data, and they're turning it into product and services of real value. They're helping people, and when they're helping people, that's a value people are willing to pay for. That marketplace, this ecosystem of data, in many ways, frankly, is invisible. Most folks don't see it, don't care about it, not that they even should. But the fun part is that businesses are noticing, investors are noticing, and there is a degree of investment that is fueling a lot of these businesses to grow, and that's what was in the Wall Street Journal article and quite a few other pieces. McKinsey, the Global Institute, just came out with a study, said that the economic potential of open data across a few different sectors is anywhere between $3 and $5 trillion, with a T, trillion. And that's just from new business, again, measured by the product and services sold, fueled by open data. I'll give one example, again, from the information at the city level. So many of you may be familiar with Yelp. Yelp is a business rating system. Anyone can use it to say whether a restaurant's great, or whether they want to take a picture of their dog after a funny haircut. Well, Yelp uses city data, particularly on restaurants, through basically a data standard. It's a way to get the data from a city regardless of how messy it is. Well, Yelp is able to actually figure out, by ingesting information from your portal, if lo and behold that taco stand on the corner has a failing safety record. Or in my case, the city where I live, I found out my favorite place had a dangerously low safety rating. I don't take my baby there anymore. Right? I know that because Yelp translated that data for me. City data may have been a little dirty. They found a way to engage with our portal. They inform those citizens. Citizens are making healthier choices. Lo and behold, Yelp gets greater traffic on their website, which is how they make money, and that's how jobs happen. So, again, it's this raw to wholesale to retail. The dirty data, the raw data, the information that you're generating. If you give it out to the right people, particularly in Dallas, one of your greatest natural resources are businesses, are the people that reside here, you have an unusually high capability of converting this information into something that people can actually use. I've talked about Trulia, I've talked about Zillow, I mentioned a lot of the major companies in terms of their way of transforming this information. I'll round out with just a few more stories about how people can play. So my guess is that you have some great ways to find the parks, to find a lot of the public spaces, the thriving art community in Dallas. But it's not always very easy for folks to figure out exactly where it is within that park, if they want to maybe throw a birthday party or to be able to get a little more granular information. Well, your Rec and Park Department, I don't know if there's anyone here representing that department or anything in that regard, but lo and behold, there's some companies like Appalicious out of San Francisco, even the Googles of the world, who are trying to help folks take all that geospatial data, the maps, the visualizations, the blueprints of buildings, and helping folks find what they're actually looking for, make those reservations for the birthday party on the weekend, and go to that outdoor grill, and be able to leverage your public spaces in a way that they could not if they were just trying to plan it at home. So I'll cut off here, and again, in summary, I'll just say that we need to put government technology in context. It's not just about how we can pay for parking tickets online. It's really how do we create a different type of experience with citizenry? How can folks complain about the cleanliness of their town through a 311 system? Or how can people actually create new business and products by saying, you know what, your city probably has building data. You guys probably have crime information, you have business information. How do we transform that and turn those into things that people really care about? That business empowerment is something that we are very proud to do with the hundreds, if not thousands, of businesses that we work with every day at Socrata, to fuel them with the information that they use to deliver on many of the goals that the city cares about. So I'll close off there. I don't think we had questions for the earlier panel, but I want to at least provide a few questions from my side. So maybe I'll open it up. I don't know if I can do that and just start the. Oh, please, please.
In the city's IT is made up, and I'll kind of do it in steps. I mean, it starts with it. The first step, there's a network. Okay, these are our foundation things. There's computers. You have a data center in this facility. You have a couple of others throughout the city where we have things. On that is where the data is stored, and the software resides. The network is done by. You have a small group internally, but we have primarily outsourced our network services to AT&T. So they are there's the network. Then you have the computers, so the things that are in your office, what you're using there today. We actually have transitioned that support and service to a company called CompuCom. They're a local Dallas-based firm. And then from the data and the application, we still have a lot of that internally that we manage. These are staff members, employees, but we have begun to shift some of those things. You heard Eric talk about software as a service. For example, our SAP billing and collection, that is now no longer running in the city. It's no longer hosted here. That is run by a company called Deloitte. And they have partnered with a firm to handle all the computers and the backups and the recovery of it. So I don't know if that's kind of got where we needed to go.
And then you've got, I'm sorry, you've got the computers, the systems, the means that we put more stuff in cloud.
Cloud is where we're shifting. Today, our first step into the cloud is email. So Microsoft, we're actually using Microsoft's cloud solution. So
we've got four of the half a dozen suppliers on each of these levels.
Yes, sir.
These guys are talking about the what ifs of the
right.
Thank you.
That's
I just
right.
wanted for this group to kind of, I mean, I really wanted for me.
And,
for
and I do think that that's helpful, but also telephone. Systems, the radio systems, all those are additional foundational components which
right.
and sometimes are operating by themselves, but sometimes are connecting up data as
right.
well
right.
across
yes.
systems.
Yes, our voice, our telephone system is also part of that AT&T managed service contract. So they do the phone, the telephone, and the data, which is the internet, the connections of things that run on our computer. The radio piece we still have internally. And there's some significant changes we're looking at in that area because of the growth and the capacity, because video, you heard some of them talk about video. We've talked about video surveillance in the police department and the growth of that, and now video moving into the court system so that prosecution begins to look at video before it actually goes to trial. Was that you on that video? Did you do that? Do you really want to go to trial with that? No, I think I'll just pay.
A couple of other points, and Ian, you did a great job about describing the kinds of things that your company does. I'm sorry that you didn't bring actually something that we could put up in terms of the visual of what that software does. It is extremely powerful in terms of the software applications that they have developed, not only just bring data and connect it up with the various organizations and parties, but the software itself actually enables the user to be able to put it into graphic comparisons, put it into mapping displays in a very intuitive and quick way. So we already have organizations, housing organizations and others, that are signing up to see about getting our data, but then using that software to be able to analyze it and put it into applications for themselves almost immediately. One of the other concepts that wanted to mention is that the one of the other functions that we're really looking at in turning mentality around is that each one of our various parts of the organizations that has a software application, court system or whatever, police, whoever is doing the business that they're doing but has an application in their department, we're really looking at it in a much different way. That is, how is that same information that's being derived for that department useful for other departments? And so the concepts that we're talking about here, as far as the interconnectivity of the data, will not really be taken full advantage of unless the actual mentality of how we approach these software applications are viewed and how they are developed. And so with that paradigm shift is as important as any of the technology that they're talking about.
I love, if I can just give two very, very quick examples of how that actually works. Thank you so much for saying that. I'll give two of my favorites, and I won't pick on Dallas. I'll pick on some other cities just to show how this actually plays out. Here's a fun example of these two different departments working together. Imagine a map of childhood obesity rates. Now picture a map of high school graduation rates. You know what? I'll go to just about any other city in America. You overlay those two maps, you're going to see some striking similarities. One's Department of Health, one's Department of Education. That type of information drives policy, or should. That type of information drives decision-making. But you can't get that data unless you have, to your point, a way to overlay that in a simple, easy way. And I'm very proud to say that we're part of that solution. We're not the only ones doing it, but we're part of that solution. Another fun one in terms of driving decision, you know, when you engage the citizenry, it's really funny what comes up. So I won't pick on the city because I know this is being watched a few places. But there's one city where some citizens were looking at crime data. And they were looking at crime data for their neighborhoods, and they found out, lo and behold, the oldest job in the world and a few other pieces of crime were taking place in their neighborhoods only on the first of the month. First day of the month was the only time these crimes were ever being reported anywhere. Of course, that's ridiculous. That's not how the world actually works. That's just the only day of the month that the police were doing a tour of their neighborhoods. And lo and behold, those neighborhoods where there was always some sort of crime being reported and apprehended. So what does that mean for the average person? Well, they're going to say, well, that's ridiculous. I don't want the police swimming through my neighborhood once a month. There's a problem here. You got to at least go twice a month. Come on, take it up a notch. That type of informed citizenry drove this one city to engage their police department, say, thank you very much for your once-a-month swing by. I need you to come by a little bit more often because we have a crime problem. Right? That information didn't come from a journalist, didn't come from an elected official, didn't come from some outside. That was local mothers and fathers being a little concerned about the safety of their kids walking to school. And so that's what happens. That's the reaction, the democratic response to more informed citizenry.
Okay. Okay. And you got some questions. Okay.
Thank you, Scott. Comparison IIT with other major cities in America and in the world, how do you compare that? Plus, if this was a private corporation, how would you compare the city of Dallas to a large corporation of this size with the network and the software we're doing?
From a comparison between, you could look at government to
government. It's a government.
To government. So you could look at government, and you would compare. Size would be done by the number of computers that you have, the number of applications, the size of your data. That's the way we did it 25 years ago when I was in the banking world, and we competed against, we compared ourselves as best practice, who was the best out there at running IT, the most efficient, cost-effective. We do something similar like that in government. And second,
so how do we compare Dallas to who?
Well, a lot of it is they do have statistics. We have firms like Gartner and Forrester that we subscribe to, so they give us this data. We actually provide them our data, so we put things about how many computers, how many FTEs, employees, those things, what we spend on IT into that, and they take that and compare us to other local governments, state, county, federal level, so we can see ourselves as to where we stand there. And second, I call.
Okay, so my simple question, how we compare to what other city in Dallas or in the world? Well, I mean, compare. I mean, okay. We know what I say. That's what I'm trying to say, how far we're behind. We can't compare in the municipality. What about the private, you know? So.
Well, we're not, from the terms of whether we're behind or ahead or whatnot, you know, when I look at our data compared to what Gartner compares, you know, to other state and local, so I'm going to have to look at that level. We are, I'm going to say, much more efficient as far as what we're doing. We're considerably below the average where others are in terms of their spend. Now, how do I sort of take and, I don't want to say justify, but confirm that? I have contacts. So I visit with my counterparts in Fort Worth or Austin or Houston or San Antonio. In this case, just a couple of weeks ago, I was visiting with the CIO of Austin. The CIO there called and said, I'm calling you. I'm calling New York, Chicago, Philly, and San Diego. He said, my city management just told me to cut 40% of my budget. So he's doing some investigation. He said, so he's looking for best practices. How can I cut 40% and still deliver? Because we're kind of known out there as doing it right.
Okay. So, well, I think I get it. I think I'll say we probably below average. That's what I hear. I mean, that's what I hear you said. I might be wrong.
Let
me phrase that right.
So there are two elements. One is cost per computer. Okay.
Yes, sir.
Right. And the second is quality of product, which is whether it's innovation or speed to customer.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
You say we're in the top half of efficiency. We're doing better than most there.
Right.
How about the second one?
The efficiency?
No.
Oh.
The quality.
Quality. From my standpoint and where we're looking, we're there or better than that as a city from an IT standpoint.
Okay.
Thank you. Right.
Mr. Kleinman, Chevy had a question, but that's all right. Mr. Kleinman, go first.
Yeah, either way, I'm just actually looking on the data visualizer right now, and we have a dead body on Maple Avenue. We have a major disturbance on Fort Worth Avenue. Domestic violence. You might want to check on that. But these are open. These are actually open police call records that they're currently working. So it's pretty easy just to drill down, and that is obviously available just right through our website. I couldn't get the map to work, so maybe I need a little training on it.
Oh.
But DallasCityHall.com. Right hand side, there's a thing that says open data, and you just click on that, and you can just request data set. So that's pretty cool. There's a lot there. Things. As we move forward in things like this, I think we also have to look at some of our just kind of routine systems. I know that, and we've talked about a few of my pet peeves, but like, why do we print out memos and then scan them and then email them to people? Why don't we just email somebody the information? I mean, I don't get that one. We've talked about constituent management or CRM for the city. This is a big thing that my office and Jennifer's and Scott's office have started into kind of as a pilot where we're getting all our constituent information into a database so that when someone calls in, we know what they've done, we know why they're calling, we can create opportunities to serve that take more time. And this is for working on things beyond just a simple service request. Simple service request, just go to our service request system. But I think I'd like to see us expand on that a little bit more. And one of the things that Bill and I have talked about a little bit is what is the one defining thing for the city of Dallas across all these data sets? And typically, and I think one of the most used ones, is address. That is kind of the one thing that no matter which department you're in or what you're doing, it's kind of like all tied to an address. So that is actually a good link to come together. And at one point, my colleague, Ms. Davis, had even talked about having an app or something like that where you could put an address and just see everything that's happening there. So it's kind of like this kind of like Dallas 360. It would query all systems in Dallas. And just here's the list of things that are going on at that address. And so I think those are the kind of exciting things that we can do in the city and would like to see y'all continue pursuing that. We, Bill and I also talked about this concept of a reverse 311 email, so that basically every physical address has an email address. Like my personal one would be 11322 East Rick Circle at DallasCityHall.com or Dallas311.com. And then if I own that address, I can just subscribe to that inbox. And that way, if something citywide, it goes to all addresses. If something specific to me, it goes to my address. I mean, those kinds of ideas are ways that we can connect with our constituents and that we can provide more information to our constituents. And I'm very excited about those kinds of things, and Bill is too. Definitely like to see us move forward with the video conferencing. We've talked about trying to enable links or some other video conferencing product. Definitely like to see us move forward on the concept called workflow, which I think is a major, major problem in this city, is the lack of workflow. And the whole conversation we had yesterday about what was the purchasing cutoff for the council office, workflow is completely tied into that. Every time you try to order something, nobody even knows what the process is. I mean, when we ordered our Salesforce licenses, for example, the first time I ordered them, I was able to get them ordered on a P card. And when Jennifer went to order them, her department, her folks had to fill out 15 million forms and had to go through. What was the difference? I don't know. But there was not even a paperwork flow, not even a checklist. It simply said, if you want to order a piece of software, do this. It's just kind of up in people's heads. And I think that's problematic because that creates problems and that creates creates errors. So I think for some of those things, we can do it on paper with books and manuals, stuff like that, or we can build it into systems where we can just have simple workflows so that A, we don't miss things along the way, and B, everyone's very clear on the process. So those are, I mean, you guys are talking about great big data and all this. We got some much more fundamental things going on here that need help. So I appreciate that. Another thing I wanted to mention to the group and to y'all as well is this city is moving, I think, from a technology focus, as in how many computers do we need and how many servers do we need, and da-da-da, to an information focus. That is a major move. As council members, as long as the budget's there, we don't really care what machine it's running on or how many servers we have or how fast the network is. What we need to care about is, can we get access to the information we need quickly and can be analyzed easily? So, you know, it's Bill's headache to worry about getting it to our desktop, but our focus should be on that we have it on the desktop and that we can access and leverage it. And that moves us, that's what we've talked about, it moves us along this line from just simple data to information to now we have knowledge of what's going on in our city and what's going on with constituents. And that's an important push for us and to stay focused on. So, hey, do we care if a server's in the basement or it's out in the cloud? As policymakers, we shouldn't give a crap. What we care about is, can we log in immediately and see what are the open service calls going on? Or can we log in immediately and see what crime things are going on? That's what we care about. And then we can respond to our constituents. And so I think that's an important thing that Bill has brought to the table. And it really, you know, his role is moving from like a chief technology officer to a chief information officer. And that is what we need to think about information. And that is phone systems are information, computer systems are information, radio system information, all this stuff is information. And it's up to Bill and his staff to get it in a form that we can utilize it and leverage it. So I'm very excited about that kind of thing. I'm excited that we're embracing transparency as opposed to resisting transparency. As much as we scream about transparency and as much as people scream at us about transparency, I'd be interested to see how many constituents have actually logged into this Open Data website. It's probably not as many as we would have
liked. It's pretty good, actually.
I'm glad.
It's pretty good.
Yeah.
That's pretty good.
The level of access to your site.
What numbers does that mean?
You have, since the launch, I think the exact date is a few months ago, we're talking thousands of folks, individuals, who have gotten your police data, building inspection, payroll.
50,000 or 6,000?
Low thousands, two, 3,000s.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, in context, right? For just starting and for not having a tremendous amount of public outreach, that is compared to where New York and San Francisco, those folks who did 4 or 5 years ago, that's about where they were at.
And so the thing about that is right now, it is just that, open data. I wouldn't say it's open information. Okay, so I mean, if someone can go in and drill down and find the stuff, but you know, a few years from now, hopefully someone can go in and go to open data and do a search. Where are the open police cases in my neighborhood? And through that kind of just common language searching, just find that stuff out. How many, can you show me the relationship between the locations of SOBs and crime statistics? I mean, literally type that in, and open data will bring that back. So that's really where we're going. I mean, you guys are kind of open the tin can to see what's in there, but really the next step is kind of really cook the meal.
It is really hard to open that tin can, though.
Yeah, because you're dealing with so much legacy data.
Yeah.
But that's not our problem. That's Bill's problem, right? So, and that's how we need to think about it. So I'm excited about it. There are a lot of places to go and a lot of things to do, but I'll continue to push the envelope on this stuff because I think that this open access to information, not only for us but for our constituents, is really, really helpful, and it can really make you look really smart. I mean, our offices do it all the time. I mean, we keep records of activity, and someone says da 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 da, and you're like, yeah, I see you called me about this on this such a date, and here's what I did, and here's the string of emails that we have kept on that, and or here's where you go and find that. I mean, my office does it all the time. They not only give somebody the answer, they also show somebody where to get the answer, and that can really be helpful as well. So thanks, guys.
Well, I'm not going to thank you because you let him go before me, and now I'm really going to show my ignorance. I mean, he's very tough to follow, and I'm very ignorant to the computers, so the questions I ask, I'm amateurish, and I'm going to put my ignorance out on the table. First off, I thought cloud had nothing to do with anybody but Mac. I thought Mac was the only one that had cloud. But it's on all the systems have cloud. Is that correct?
Correct.
Yes,
but I still, to this day, I don't know whether I'm using it or not. Maybe I am. I don't know. So I don't understand that system. Here's what I wanted to ask, and I think I wanted to ask it to Mr. Smith. You made the statement that if you go into the coffee shop and I walk in with my phone, and if I turn it on and do anything on it, they got me and they know everything about me. Is that true? Even if I don't have it input into my phone. You say they know my age, they know how much money I make, they know.
Yeah, let me try to unpack that a little bit. As it relates to privacy, the way the rules are, if we're using aggregate and anonymous data, the customer has to have the ability to opt out of that program.
You need to explain what that's
saying. Yeah.
So in the demo, it was not individual data on a specific individual that was being used in that demo. It was a collection of information on a number of people that was aggregated together, right? And it was anonymized, meaning there's no individually recognizable, data about an individual, right? And the rules around use of data like that is that even at that level, customer has to have the ability to opt out of that program, right? So you can offer a service where they're, in essence, opted in, but they have to have the option to opt out. If you're using data that's individually identifiable data, then the customer has to opt into that. And there has to be a value exchange that you've given the customer something for using their individualized data. And so in cases of individualized data usage, would be, a targeted ad. So if you we know you're a sports enthusiast or whatever, we're going to give you a certain ad that's relevant to your, individual taste. In that case, at least in our world, you've got to opt into that and say, yeah, I want that, more relevant advertising. and there has to be a value exchange where we've given you something for that.
Does it have to be any more than them coming up and saying, if you want to use our system, you have to sign this agreement?
No.
Before
it has
you
to
can
be more
opt
than that.
In?
So in our, you know.
How would I opt in?
So let's take a Kindle Fire kind of example.
Yeah.
So Kindle has two versions of the Kindle, one that's ad-supported and one that's not. The ad-supported version is, I forget what the number is, let's say it's $100 less than the non-ad-supported. So you could buy the $300 Kindle and not get ads, meaning they're not taking your usage data and giving you ads that are relevant to your, you know, whatever profile. Or you can say, I'm going to take the ad-supported version, and so I get a $100 discount. So instead of $300, it's a $200 tablet. So that's kind of where the, you know, Federal Trade Commission and, you know, so we've, you know, been working this for, you know, for quite a number of years. But that's sort of the rules of the game. Now, you know, is that the way it's going to be forever? And, you know, as people realize, you know, how valuable their personal data is and what's the, you know, what are the policies going to be? But that's sort of the state of the art today in terms of the policy.
So if they just take it at random and it's not individual, they really don't know which one I am.
Correct.
I'm talking about the coffee shop. The
Correct.
Coffee shop, I walk in and they pull the data off my system. They actually don't know who I am.
Correct.
Well, how do they know my name and my age and my everything like
yeah,
that?
So
how do they know my how do they know my income? Somebody's getting it.
Yeah, somebody is. So in their, you know, AT&T's one, there, you know, lots of internet companies that are collecting that data, there are various sources for that data that are being put together, right? So there are third-party data providers that have data on income and other demographic kind of information. And so that data can be associated and then anonymized and then, meaning stripped the individual identity and then aggregated, and that's what's, you know, that's what I was describing about anonymized. So it's not just from the fact that you walked in with a smartphone in the coffee shop. There are other data sets out there that are being aggregated with, you know, you as a, you know.
Okay. So they can see what's on there, but how can they tell if I don't have it input on my equipment? How do they know? How do they know?
With AT&T. They know that your phone is hooked to them. It's in their database.
So it's from AT&T. Okay, I'm now.
They're not doing it.
Okay,
AT&T,
it's coming from AT&T.
They know everything about you.
Yeah.
They take your
okay.
name out. They package it together.
Yeah.
And someone wants to buy that information.
That's where they're getting it from, is you guys.
Right.
Now,
an example I showed, but
now,
I mean, this is a broader.
That's okay. I wasn't understanding. Now I understand how they could get that because they go through you. They pay you.
Yeah,
for
and there,
that.
There are third parties that are doing it, you know, exactly the same way with, you know, with Wi-Fi and reading it.
Yeah,
right.
I know.
Right.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Taxes, you know, so we'd be able to assess that without obvious. And
What, as I said, there's sort of, you know, it's what data, how's it collected, and how is it used, or sort of the from a network. Like I say, for years we've been collecting data, so we know even if you have your GPS on your phone turned off, right by the cell tower locations, we can triangulate location. We've used that for E911 purposes as well, but we use it for network. So we use that from a network performance, so we know where there are drop calls or, you know, and that sort of thing. So that's data that we're collecting that for network purposes is deemed, you know, fair use for us to use that in that fashion. If we're using it for something beyond that, right, and then that's when it gets into this whole, you know, opt-in, opt-out. So you have an option not to have us collect that data from your cell phone, and you know, you go to the website and opt out, right? If on an aggregate anonymous. So the opt-in is something you can't opt out of us using the data for network performance purposes, but for any other purpose you can opt out of it. The opt-in using specific data, where we've come out as a company, and not everybody, I maybe overstated, where we've come out as a company, if we're going to use individual data for targeted advertising purposes, you have to opt into that. And so we just launched something called Internet Preferences, which is that. It's only, we've just launched it on one service, you know, where you opt in, you specifically opt in, you get a lower price, you know, $29 less per month, if you let us send you targeted advertising, for example. So that's a, you know, that's another business model that says it's ad supported, not unlike, you know, TV and, you know, other sorts of things where you have part subscription, part advertising supported. Well, that was a whole net neutrality that had to do with treating different traffic differently, and that was more of a jurisdictional issue where the FCC didn't have jurisdiction over the internet.
So maybe if I can take a chance to organize the context. So not all data is created equal, right? And I would say that in this evolving marketplace, you have three, if you can imagine, three circles that overlap each other a bit. You got the big data, you have my data, my cell phone, my medical record, my energy bill, and then there's open data. Three separate spheres, and there's overlap. Sometimes open data is big data, every single bus in America where it is at any given time. Sometimes my data becomes open data, my census. I fill out a census that's aggregated, that's and published in a way that can drive it at a higher level rather than at the individual level. So you have a bunch of these overlaps where there are different potentials, different opportunities. I think the extraordinary innovations, I think it's fair to say, from Cisco, AT&T, and others, are showing a lot of really fun stuff in the big data, my data world, individual cell phones, you aggregate it, you can figure out if after a sporting event, you need a bunch more trains here because there's an unusual concentration train. Yeah, exactly. I also, but I want to, with a bit of my own hat and responsibility, I should say that there's also an opportunity for policymakers and government administrators to say, what data do you have within government that probably belongs to the taxpayers, but you have to respect privacy and confidentiality, and there's ways to get there. But there's a way in which you can bring that data out that fits within this ecosystem. So it's not just an individual cell phone or medical record or you know, the Wi-Fi networks, but then, well, how does that relate to school closings or if the air quality control isn't that good in a certain location? How does city connect with state, and how does state connect with federal? You know, I'll tell a quick story about what's happening in Louisville, Kentucky. Mayor Greg Fisher is doing something really cool in partnership with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, which no one ever cares about talking about. But lo and behold, they have some really interesting air quality data. And what they were trying to figure out is how do you basically respond to kids that were having issues with breathing. And so they attached little Wi-Fi devices to the breathalyzers. The asthma inhalers, like breathalyzer. Asthma inhalers, that's a different thing. The asthma inhaler... Well, you know, I don't live there.
After the parking ticket.
When the kids were, exactly, right, you can show them an interesting warning, I guess. As the kids were taking those medical inhalers, it was transmitting the information to the city, and they were able to figure out, wow, we actually have an unusual smog issue because of high traffic congestion in these one neighborhoods, and all this traffic is right by the schools, who, by the way, are at the playground after school activities. So we got to redirect traffic because all these kids are taking their inhalers at the same time. Now, that's policy-driven, data-driven action that combines federal personal information, medical information, and also city data. So there are hundreds of use cases like that, and I think it's in these overlaps between open data, big data, and my data, where there's a lot of potential.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Some of my questions were already answered, but I just wanted to follow up regarding as far as like responding to back to constituents with some of them that are not, you know, using emails because, you know, we have a large population of senior citizens. So we still have to use that phone system. And I know, Mr. Gonzalez, that I had asked before if there was a way, you know, when we were doing the budget meetings, there were some ways that we can connect and contact and with other things, I think, the West Nile and all that good stuff, to be able to connect with our constituency, which is priority is connecting with our constituency somehow, somewhat, right? So I just wanted to make a comment or share that if there's a way that we can do that to also not only with this information, but also to let them know what's going on, what's the latest, when there's closures, you know, not only through email, because many don't have emails, particularly senior citizens, and how we'd be able to do that. So if we haven't done it, that's something, you know, as he states something about being able to connect with them via email and respond. I want to see if there's a way that we can also, you know, use that phone system as well for many of our constituents. The other question that I had was, as far as the phone system that we have at the office, is that like not necessarily like the latest, the best that we have to date, the, you know, latest technology or...
It's still a very modern system. In fact, we just got through doing some upgrades on it a couple of years ago. Don't necessarily have to replace the phone instrument itself that's on your desk, but the computers behind it we have to keep up to date. What's the next wave of that that's coming is the opportunity to, because so many of us are, you know, on these, this is what we use. You'd be surprised how often I walk by people's offices and there's a telephone there, but they're on this. Mm-hmm. And it's business. It's not a personal thing. It's just this. They've forwarded the phone to this. Well, now Cisco has technology and software that we will be upgrading our system to this year that will allow us to remove that desk phone and take the business number that's on there and actually put it on this device. So you can this. Therefore, then we're not paying the expense or the price for that phone because it's not being used. Again, it's one of those opt. Do you want to opt toward using this? Because if you're not using that device, we really shouldn't keep paying for it. If this is what you're most used, because we're mobile, we're all over the place. Or maybe your assistant needs to keep the phone because you may not want to answer this all the time. You may still want somebody answering your phone. They can still answer that number, that call that's going to this now on that. On that Cisco telephone at their desk.
Okay. Thank you, Mr.
Gentlemen, thank y'all for being here. This is really a treat to have folks of y'all's caliber and such. And AC, thanks for putting this together. Great vision on your part. The people ask me. They say, "Do you have a Facebook account?" You know, being an elected official and everything. And do you tweet her and all this? And my response is back to them is all I do is Google. And it's back to that information is really where I'm going because that's what we do. We have to be out in front day in and day out, new information. So I'm going to just pick, maybe Paul, each one of you would comment on this. The challenge that we face, you know, we got potholes out there. And those citizens know about potholes, particularly at campaign time, you know, because that's what they're going to talk about, those streets and those potholes. Not enough dog parks, not enough this, swimming pools, all that kind of stuff. And then when it gets down to this time, well, we're not going to talk about the money aspect of it. You know, we generally, that's, it's going to go the back burner. I think I heard Austin was talking about 40% reduction, so on and so forth. So really, if you would, if each one of you would just elaborate, because we have, and I'm very basic, but, you know, obviously the systems that we run this great city on, that's and maybe what the future is like. What would y'all do to help us streamline, or not, I use the word not help us streamline, but just the vision of this, and putting yourself in our spots of limited resources, limited, you know, you got the elected officials that want all these other candy. We want the candy, you know, because that's what the citizens want. But, and then, so help us kind of think maybe where the world's going with that. And then, but the other side is back to what I just said about me Googling and what you're talking about on this thing about the information we've got, because that's crucial what we can do. The more we know about this, the better we are, and the better we can provide a quality of life. So kind of a loaded question. I'll start with you, Eric, on that. And number one, thanks for AT&T being the world headquarters here in Dallas, Texas, buddy.
My pleasure. Yeah. It's easy to walk across the street to our neighbors here. Yeah, I think I'd probably take kind of both ends of the spectrum sort of in terms of answering that. I think, you know, given where the economy, and I touched on it in my presentation, but where the economy is headed, I think having world-class, you know, infrastructure that supports, you know, the connectivity that really provides the basis to have the new sort of connected world that drives the kind of economy and, you know, ultimately drives ad valorem taxes and sales taxes and so forth by keeping a vibrant community, make sure that infrastructure across the city is, you know, world class, I think is really critical. And I think at the other end of the spectrum, I think, you know, accessing the data, you know, freeing it up. But I think we've certainly learned a lot about our business over the last 4 years by applying, you know, the data analytics to our own business. And I think there's probably a huge opportunity for the city to use that data to manage more efficiently, to understand how things are correlated. I think several council members have touched on it. But looking at that data across the different departments and functions and how that air quality, traffic congestion, and health are related, public safety, how all those are related, I think there's a huge opportunity with big data. Without going through, you know, most in the past, that would require huge systems integration. And what we've learned with some of these open source platforms, you know, running in the cloud, use all the buzzwords at once, we're able to pull that together much more quickly without the huge upfront investment. So I think infrastructure and the data analytics are what I would suggest are maybe the two areas of potential focus.
Let me give drill into a specific use case. Given some of the questions I've heard here. So I believe the city of Dallas uses Cisco's call center technology along with our voice telephony system for the city. Within our contact center suite of applications or call center applications, we have a program called Social Miner, whereby through a series of open APIs, we mine social media traffic. And that social media traffic is then brought into the call center and presented to agents. So in your pothole example, if you have a bunch of constituents that are complaining on social media, Twitter, Facebook, pick one of the many, about potholes or about tall weeds, I heard, or about dogs being loose, you have the capabilities today to mine that data into your call center that the city uses, and then generate an automated voice response back out to those targeted areas in an automated outbound calling instead of using email. Like you said, some of your constituents don't use email. They still use the phone system. That would be a very specific use case, just in terms of your question. My colleague talked very broad. I'll take it I'll take it a little more narrow for the sake of discussion today. And thinking about the capabilities that Open Data has been enabled with, I can't imagine why we can't, there couldn't be something done to integrate the data here with what Social Miner can pull into your call centers and then present you with an ability now to communicate back out and respond in a proactive manner to your constituents prior, instead of you reacting, right? So it's a proactive pull of social media and then being able to have a proactive response back out of just when the issue will be fixed. You know, we know there's a pothole, it's creating issues, we've reprioritized the street to be fixed on in 2 weeks as opposed to a month. You've now got real-time social media information coming in. You're able to respond to it. That would be one example in terms of a vision that you could do today. We're very close to today with a lot of the assets that you have and with a small augmentation.
If I can round up very briefly, I think the future is improving the quality of democracy. And here's how I can say that. Mr. Mayor, I have some bad news. Part of City Hall is broken. It's on the second floor near the elevator. It's your candy machine. This analogy is going to make sense in a second. So on this candy machine, I think it's a hilarious example of the way citizens interact with government. Apparently, somebody tried to get something from that candy machine. Didn't work. So somebody literally, feel free after this meeting to go check it out and ensure that I'm not lying to you, somebody wrote a note and posted the note on the City Hall candy machine that says, I did not work on number 57, which is a honey bun, by the way. Please call me. I'd love a refund. Somebody took the time to write a note and post it on a candy machine in City Hall and hoping somehow, this is the funny part for me, that someone would call them and maybe help them get their $1.50 back. I actually have a lot of experiences with government that kind of feel like that. I didn't get what I paid for, and I'm a little frustrated, and I'm going to post a random complaint somewhere on Facebook, on Twitter. Maybe I'll call a city council person, and maybe that relationship is going to get improved, and maybe I'll get my money's worth. That's not the way I think government should function, and I'm stealing an analogy from a brilliant person named Tim O'Reilly, founder of O'Reilly Media. He calls government services a candy machine that you use to put money in, expect to get a driver's license out, expect to get a city permit out. But the truth is that business model is not going to work going forward. It has to be more of a two-way conversation. And when you're improving the quality of services that we call business, or that we call government, that business of government, you're not just helping folks get what they're paid for. I think you're actually improving the quality of the citizen experience. And when you're engaging citizens more, that is improving the quality of democracy.
And such an excellent point, because again, that conversation, the more they understand, the more they know. Quite frankly, the better off it is, because they hopefully can stand up and clap and say, I understand, maybe it'll take a day to get to that pothole, but you'll get it fixed in one of those type of scenarios. Again, thank you also very much for spending your time to come here. It's really a treat. I mean, it's a treat for us to have you guys here. Thank you, Mr. Mayor.
Thank you. I'm going to go back to the pothole thing, because that's a big deal. You can have mounds of information, okay, and you can say, I know just about where every pothole is in this city. But then, AC, the point I want to make is our crews go out in response, and they're going to know from what you just said that it's going to be in 2 weeks. I'm looking at you, Eric, in the middle there. It's going to be in 2 weeks instead of a month, okay? So we send our crew out, but there's a pothole, and that call has been called in. They called in this pothole. They want it fixed. But 10 feet away is another pothole, but no one's called that in. So we don't fix that pothole. We go to the next pothole that's been called in. And I get calls all the time from people that say, why didn't you fix that pothole over there? It's 10 feet away. You can see it. You're right here. So I think the key here is how do you use that mountain of information to really translate directly into what the citizens expect us to do? I mean, the answer now is, well, we didn't have that pothole on our call list, so we're going to the next one, which may be 3 miles away. And we'll get back to you, call that pothole in. So that's where I'm trying to go with this, is how do you use this mountain of information when you've got these just practical, right down on the ground kinds of problems? And our citizens are saying, but this isn't efficient. Here's the pothole right here, 10 feet away, and you've gone off and you've gone and fixed something else, but I'll be back to you in 2 weeks. So how do you answer that?
You know, and that I think is also a point about being careful what we measure. You know, when we talk about metrics and how you put things together, a lot of times you can put a metric, use a little bit different example. How long does it take to a call operator to take care of a customer? And if you measure by just the number of seconds that they would be dealing with, they find that they get more efficient less and less time, but the customers are complaining because they're being rude. They're just getting through the situation. Back to yours, we're measuring how many of the called in potholes are being taken care of, and they're reacting to that particular, you know, how much they can knock off that list. We have to think through to what extent maybe the metric has to be changed so that it rewards the correct behavior of doing exactly what you're talking about and being more efficient. So there's a lot of care that needs to be put into how the design is of the systems and how we judge success.
Yeah, because I'm listening to you three gentlemen, and it's just impressive the sorts of things that you're talking about. But we get right down to the nitty-gritty, you know. I mean, they're saying to us, this is what we expect in the way of service. So,
we need to do both.
And so to me, it's how you take that information and how you implement the actual services that you're providing.
Well, there's something analogous to what's being talked about here, and at least in the development in engineering software development world, whereby we used to follow what's called a waterfall process, which was one person said, these are the bugs to fix, these are the features, and the engineers went and did it. And they did it in that order, and they were measured on how fast they got that list done, right? And then we went to something called Agile, right? But they may miss another bug that's sitting right there that they could fix, and they knew they could fix it real quick, but I'm not being measured on that list. I got to go to the list, period, right? And we went to something recently called Agile software development. And it's rooted in a culture and in a belief that says empower the engineers. They know what's best. Mm-hmm. So give them a problem statement. Give them and we work in sprints, so very short iterations, and we measure the productivity based upon customer feedback of that sprint, of that software development sprint, and then we show it to customers. So the same thing could be done with potholes, right? Instead of measuring the list, measure how many potholes they got done in a day in their geography. I'm thinking out loud, but these are management decisions that can be made to change the processes.
That's creative. I mean, and that's the sort of thing I was thinking is, do we ever go out and ask the pothole repair crews, how could you do it better?
Part of what I had talked about as far as expanding the employee advisory groups is right along those lines. The other thing is that in terms of, again, what you measure, often in our budgeting processes and the like, we end up measuring activities, which is those things that we're describing, as opposed to results. What is at the end of the day, is it that really we accomplished? And depending, again, on how you structure the mindset about, is it about really how many potholes we fixed? Or is it really about whether or not, from a sensibility of the citizens, that we actually have better roads or not? And there we had a customer survey that we had over the last, I guess now about 6-8 years, where we've been measuring what people feel about the services that they're getting. We reported that out, and we're actually seeing that there's an increase in how well they feel that we're doing our job.
Yeah, the satisfaction rate.
In the satisfaction. Mm-hmm. And to me, that is the measure. That is really the measure about whether or not we're really fixing the potholes in a good way or not. What somewhere that's a little bit more timely is how to translate those kinds of things into something that maybe is a yearly or a monthly sort of feedback, so that we can tell whether or not citizens are feeling like we're being more efficient or are handling ourselves well as an end result, not as activities.
Because, you know, in the end, the information that people are given, it's the people and what they do with it. That's the final measure. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Grayson. I'll jump in with my questions. First of all, Bill, so we're, let's say, in the top half of government, and so I assume these other governments' computers run as slow as ours or slower?
Well, we have.
I mean, really, I mean, I speed
hear
to me is a quality issue.
Absolutely.
So they're all slower than us.
And they're... There are some that are slower. Some don't even have what we have. But
we were in the top.
Yes.
Really?
Yes.
So if I went to Topeka and ran and got on their computer, it would take that long to get stuff up.
Well, it depends.
Just randomly, or 100 of them.
I know. And Mr. Mayor, we have over 300 systems. So not all of our systems. That I would say on an aggregate, we're above that. But if you pick on one particular system, sure, we may find one that I could take, like our finance system.
I was just talking about my system, enough about everybody else. I'm just talking about me.
So you're referring to your computer in your office?
Right. Okay. I'm typing stuff, and it takes forever for things to happen.
And
so we're so much better than everybody else.
We are significantly better than others. Places that I've been.
Bill, I'm not sure why.
Smokes! I can't believe that.
Well, if the metrics, the metric that you, I don't know why you're being bashful about this. They have, there's Forrester and these other guys They have different indicators of how many FTEs you have per...
That's efficiency.
No. Wait. I'm going to get there.
That's efficiency.
Is that you have all these other efficiency-type measures as well as qualitative measures in terms of speed, et cetera.
I like to see it. That's great.
Okay, and you need to show it because it actually puts us in a very favorable light, which, to your point, if you think, if you're unsatisfied, there's a lot of other places that are even more unsafe.
That was my big question.
Right.
I mean, it was like...
Right. And please realize, I mean, it is changing so fast how people are using technology. We are right now we're in the mode of trying to upgrade within probably the last 2.5 years the Wi-Fi in the building. It just hammered us overnight. I mean, when I look today, I mean, I was like, since 2012, we have added 312 iPads. I'm like, God, it's just growing leaps and bounds, and so we're addressing the Wi-Fi on that side. We're right behind it, dealing with the network.
Okay, you answer my question.
There's another issue and the reason why I want to mention it's coming up on agenda. We've managed to find some money to see about getting an addition on a microwave system. You don't think about it, but we have all this data that we are collecting, and particularly in the video world, that we got to move around. Move around to buildings, move around the city, et cetera. We're having to spend money on basic infrastructure to move all this and to get that speed up and keep it up.
Good. Is there going to be one near my office? All right. No, that's fine. I'm sorry. It's a minor point. I really was curious about where government was overall, and if Gardner says that, Gardner's a good organization, so I'm not arguing Gardner. So let's talk about money, okay? What's your budget? Total budget, anything to have to do with IT in this city, cops, fire, the whole world?
It's approximately $70 million.
Okay, so we, the taxpayers, put in the candy machine $70 million for you to do this. So we're in the top half of performance for other government. I assume we're not in the top half versus big companies of 13,000 employees.
True.
Okay. So what the big elephant in the room for the last, where did AC go? He just left me, okay? And Mary's always told me, in the last 5 years is that we have not invested in IT. When it's become budget time, we do not invest in IT, right? And so what do we need to invest on a per annum basis over and above the $70 million to say, all right, we're starting to make headway in this issue?
Okay.
I'm not asking a budget presentation. I was asking ballpark. Is this another $25 million or is this $5
million? My estimation would be, you know, it would be somewhere between the 10 and the 20 million to raise us to the level where the rest of the average is from Gartner. So how they measure it is they measure it in the IT spend to the overall operating spend of the company or the organization. So where the average is,
that's a bad metric.
Well,
that dumbs it down. It really does, because I want to applaud our efficiency. I want to keep us at that quotient. So I'm not trying to go down there. I'm trying to get us to the 95 percentile of government.
Right. And I agree with you. And those are the conversations AC and I have had, looking at those numbers of where the average is, where we are, which the average is between 3.5% and 4%. We're at 1.8%. We're that far below the average. So, but I agree with you, because in the private sector, we got points. We got our bonuses based on being efficient. And I think the same thing should apply in government. So it's not, I'm not saying we raise it to where the average is. I want to stay below the average, but do a better job.
And the other aspect of it is you want to make whatever that incremental and increase investment in a smart way to get more, you know, more bang. Now, there's another factor that we haven't been talking about, and that's the entrepreneurship opportunity. You know, we're a big organization, a big customer, which when we start having to do things, particularly in the radio world and some others, you know, we make investments that ought to be, in my mind, attractive to some of these others as to whether or not it's not just a customer relationship, but a partnership relationship. And from that standpoint, then we start looking at, well, maybe that revenue picture, that, you know,
cost revenue picture
starts changing when we might be able to change some of the things that we're doing from just spend into making some money.
Yeah, but that's optimizing and taking to the next level. I was asking a base question, that if we spent $10 to $20 million in next year's budget over what we got, we start to step function the quality of what we do in IT.
Absolutely, Mr. Mayor. And along with that is the efficiency.
$30 million is like, we can't digest that enough.
Right.
And $3 million is not going to make a lot of difference.
And to keep in mind, too, we're also finding the efficiencies now. Now that we've kind of got to that place that I talked about 18 months ago where I said we've got a lot of work to do to bring some of our older systems up to where they are, we've also, through that, found efficiencies. I'll take library, for example. With our partnership with AT&T, the federal government came out with a new cost price for the network that they're subsidizing. They immediately call us and say, hey, we've got an opportunity here. So we got a 300% increase in capacity and lowered the price 65%. Wow, that's the good stuff
there.
All right. Can I just comment with regards to that question? Part of that question is still thinking very much around hardware, like what can we buy to make it better? And one of the problems we have in purchasing is they do not understand buying services. And part of the problem is because typically when we buy hardware, we amortize it over several years. Yeah. And when you buy services, you're much better when you buy you're either buying a monthly contract, but if you'll contract for 3 or 4 years, you can actually get a reduction in price. But our purchasing can't obligate the city to anything over the current budget year and all these kind of crazy things like that. But a lot of the things that these guys are talking about aren't about putting more iron in the basement. It's about contracting with people like AT&T and others to just do that
for us.
For
longer periods of time.
And doing it for us.
Well, we contract with people all the time for long periods of time, right?
Okay, well.
Trust me, we pick up trash for a long period of time.
Mr. Mayor. But we do need to think differently about that. And the thing is that kind of spend helps us actually helps us stay current, because those guys are obligated to keep up with the latest and greatest and whatever, and their stuff can't go stale or they'll lose customers, whereas our stuff can go stale in a year. I mean, our Wi-Fi network's probably, you know what, stale 2 or 3 years after?
Is this on money and budget? Okay, please, yeah.
I guess my question would be very simple, that we got so many different departments. We're talking about the council department. I didn't just want to know what each department charged to pay back in. Then we could find out, okay, the council department, we're going to talk about potholes or whatever, what do we pay, how much it costs? Then you can figure that real quick. The police, the fire take 85% of that budget, so therefore if they got 60% of the whole general fund, we might have 3%, and we don't have
enough
money in there.
That's a good pie chart to look at.
So that's a pie chart, and then we find out where we short at.
Who are the big users? Who are the big users? What are they getting charged? That's good.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes, please, Mr.
I liked your two about just really nailing down to the cost itself and then asking that question, what do we need to make it even better and get it to the level we have? And as soon as you said that, my mind went to that same approach as what we took with the police department. And we said, did. All right, this is what we're going to step up, and this is what we're going to do and what we're going to commit to do. And today, obviously, we've seen the results of that. And so I would applaud you and stand beside you when it came to making it that level. Let's take it to this next level. Let's give these folks.
Yeah. And, Mr. Allen, I think you're dead right, and that's why we're having meetings like this, Council, okay, because we get into these arguing over the purchases we make, and we don't step back.
Right.
And look in $10 and $20 million increments, and what are we going to cut, and what are we going to spend, and that's important. Did you have a question on finance, on money? Okay, I want to go to one other place, and then I'll let you go, Mr. Ernst. Would you step up here because I'm getting into a little squishy area. Yeah. I mean, I want us to all talk about it, but I want you to be sitting here at the table because there's a whole deal. Look, in the world of connectivity, as AT&T kind of is focused on, it's a two-way street. And I think we all like transparency, and at the same time, we all like privacy. And so we all get all... you know, goofy, you know, when people say, well, they're peering into this and Edward Snowden's got my backyard information or something, all right? Obviously, this is the Wi-Fi works both ways. And I want you guys to opine a little bit on how we should be thinking about and approaching this issue philosophically, not to put more money in your pockets, but to be responsible stewards as a city leadership on this. For me, I'm an old marketer, so this is a very simple proposition. I want to give as much information as I can on a passive standpoint to people that are interested. But a couple of thousand people looking into this thing doesn't excite me, all right? What excites me is Mr. Kleinman's idea that everybody's got an email address that pays taxes and that we are in constant communication with those people on issues that are West Nile-oriented or domestic violence or whatever the issue might be. Furthermore, while I appreciate these surveys we do, they're dinosaur-like in how the information is gotten, where we can know down to the gnats, you know what, okay, how people are feeling about potholes, okay, in Ms. Grayson's district and in certain neighborhoods, and how well people are doing. And I want to responsibly interact with those people, sending information, getting information back, and that is worth a lot more than $10 to $20 million to me. That changes this whole city in a major way. We don't have big conversations about plastic bags here, acting like we all know what's going on. We can get real-time information from citizens of how important this issue is, or whatever the issue might be, that we act like we're the authorities on, and and we just kind of read and we talk to a few people. And how do we create that dialectic in a way where people feel empowered and that we're not, you know, intruding on their lives? So I asked that in a general way, and I wanted you to sit up there because, you know, you've got a few points of view on this as well. So take it away, whoever wants to talk.
I'm ready with the legal aid.
I will say that, you know, this is an area that public sentiment is evolved and changing.
Please get close to the mic. Thanks.
What I was saying is that, you know, the public's view about this is changing over time. It's evolving as we all are on the Internet. We've now sort of gotten used to the fact that regardless of what website we're on, we may get an advertisement for shoes if we were just looking, you know, at shoes on another website. And so what we see in focus groups, you know, it kind of shakes out into maybe sort of three buckets of people. Generally, we're going to see about 80% of people that just, they know that, you know, they quote-unquote know this is being used. They couldn't care less. They're just completely relaxed about their data being used to give them, you know, targeted ads or however it's used in terms of providing feedback. There's about another 15% that are sort of bothered by it, but if it's a good service or a good value, they're in. So, you know, and then there's probably 5% that, you know, don't want that to be, don't want their data collected in any way, shape, or form. And it does skew a little bit, you know, by age group. You know, younger folks are just a lot less sensitive about the use of their data. And I mean, this is just, you know, what we see in the statistics when we do the focus groups. I would say from a philosophy, if you ask permission, you know, you're in a much better place, right? And if we're going to do something that's specific with an individual customer, you know, having them opt into that, so explicitly, you know, they've got to read kind of terms of service and explicitly opt in, then that's kind of the highest level of permission, if you will. There are some things that, and again, we have a lot of attorneys. We work with the Federal Trade Commission and others and kind of have worked through this. Not to say this, the bar won't move over time, the other part I would say, ask permission and give them something in value in exchange for using their data. So I think at a philosophical level, you know, I would suggest
getting them to buy in.
Right.
To this dialogue.
That they're seeing that there's something value that they're getting as a citizen by use of their data.
Yeah. So I think just to build on that a little bit, that philosophically speaking, I think you got to go, Mr. Mayor, where you're going in some of the questions about IT. Where does IT fit in this city? Why is it important? Is it there because you got to have a computer? I got to get the cheapest way to get it, but, you know, I got to have it. Or is it an integral part of the culture of this organization, of this leadership, of how we serve our constituents? And how can it help them? What can we do to help people with the information? How can IT improve the way we work together, improve the way we work with our constituents, improve the way we play, improve the way we live? And I think culturally, you're starting to ask the right questions. We want to talk about philosophy and vision of change and embracing this, these trends around big data and collecting data, and is it a violation of my privacy or is there a benefit to me? Well, I think it needs to start in this room with where does IT play? Where does information technology play?
I'm asking you, where do you think we should be saying, what we should be saying?
Well, I think you ought to be considering it as just as important as the police and fire capabilities to protect and serve your constituents and protect the city. I think it has to rank that high. And I think then you start to weave it into everything you do. And I'm not talking about budget spend. I'm talking about the importance of where IT can play and what you do.
Going where I articulated kind of a one-to-one was per citizen. I mean, it...
Absolutely.
Okay.
And the technology is available today to do that.
If I can just briefly build, at the national level, the president's philosophy is open by default. That is a change of culture. Assume that it belongs to the people. Privacy needs to be protected. Confidentiality needs to be protected, but open by default. And that philosophy changes a lot of things about, well, actually, wait, who gets to have access to this information? How am I going to serve these folks? That philosophy is in the national digital government strategy. So this is a benchmark from the national perspective. Now I'm going to go away from the party line. This is not my company's opinion. This is my opinion. Oh. I'm sorry. I speak a little too fast because I get carried away with this stuff. I apologize. I'll repeat it, that the president's philosophy is open by default. And there's a document. Yes. If you're by a computer, so I'll suggest you, if you were to search digital government strategy, the national digital government strategy, it defines what that means. And it's 10 points.
What does it really mean?
What does it really mean? It means that the information belongs to the people. The government is a steward.
The fact that AT&T has got my information is the government's information?
Well, actually, AT&T is in a different position than I would say you are, because you are a representative of the people. You are a public institution. AT&T may or may not be a private institution, depending on how you define that data. But the philosophy that the president has taken with its digital resources is that it is as important as crime and firefighting to a city. It is a national asset. Data is an asset. It's literally in the strategy. Data is an asset. It belongs to the people. We need to protect... your data belongs to you. So and forgive me for paraphrasing a long speech from the president, but I'll describe it as saying that if there is information generated by public tax dollars, public should have access to it in some way. And your data should be delivered to you. Your medical record should be able to access your medical record in a digital way, in a secure way, and you should have access to that just like you have access to your credit report, or you should be able to have access to your energy bill. That is the philosophy of our White House right now, is that data is an asset. I'll refer to that reference. It's much more eloquently described than how I paraphrased it. But I'm going to disagree with Eric a little bit, if I may, in terms of the types of people, the 5% who goes on Facebook and the 20% who maybe doesn't trust them. I don't think it's individuals who go feel that every way. I think that changes throughout the course of the day, depending on who they're interacting with. My personal philosophy is that privacy is a currency, not a religion. I'm willing to give my privacy to Google and to Apple because I get awesome stuff from them. This stuff rocks. I get all sorts of good services from them. But if I'm not happy with my government, I'm going to complain about their use of my privacy because I'm not getting what I'm paying for. I'm giving you my privacy, but I'm getting junk in return. That's my philosophy. And if you really want to get a happy constituency on data, you need to be delivering the services that they're paying for. And that, I think, speaks to a bit of the Snowden and other concerns there. But the open by default is not just at the federal level. I'll return to your question. A number of other cities are pursuing that, and states as well. New York State has an open by default. San Francisco has an open by default. Even Austin is going into that direction as well.
Great. Thank you very much. Warren, you got anything to add to this from a lawyer standpoint?
Well, as a conservative lawyer, I love the idea of open data. I have to say, I love that. And let's talk philosophically. I love the idea of open data. The Wall Street Journal article about the innovative and entrepreneurial excitement that can be generated by a city making its data available is very exciting. We also operate within a plethora of state and federal and common law privacy laws. And so every time we move forward in that, we just have to be careful. That's really, I guess, my message. Council Member Hill was probing, asking the question, is her data public data? And that's an example of, and the answer was very well phrased, information generated by the government is public. And that's different than information provided by a citizen being public. And that distinction is an important one. And as we move towards open data, we just need to be cautious of that. So my water bill, which might have as part of my applying for a water bill, I might have given some private data, my driver's license, my date of birth, my social security number, is held by the government, is not, should not be part of open data. We just need to be careful as we work that through. On the other hand, the statistics about which neighborhoods use how much water and which neighborhoods are doing a better job of conservation of water, that's important data, and getting the data out there so that maybe neighborhoods will do a better job, maybe some entrepreneur will come up with some way to make a buck and conserve water is an exciting thing. So,
good. Well, thank you. Look, it's 4:30 and we've got a meeting at 5 across town, so we're going to pull it. I want to come back to Mr. Allen's challenge to us that we need to think hard about this issue just like we did public safety. And let's not let this drop going forward and how we wrestle through this. I mean, that's the purpose of these offsites, is to put a stake in the ground and try to get there, you know, sooner versus later. I don't, you know, it's like, well, we'll get it done in 3 years. What's our vision? What do we got to do this year? And what are the tough decisions we're going to have to make to get there? So thank you, AC. Good,
and thank you all.
Time.
Just some announcements. The vans will depart at L1 Green at 5:10 to get to the precinct at 5:30. Ballet is available. So if you want to valet your car, all you have to do is, if you want to, leave a tip. It'll be taken care of.
Is that right there on the first floor? Is that where? Is that
17? We're going to the Crescent Club where we had dinner.
Okay. Can I ask one question real quick?
Yeah. Please, Mr. Allen.
Did a computer generate these names and stuff on this? This is
about,
it's kind of small. I was just curious. That's human or computer?
There you go. I can see it.
Man, they need to make
it. All right,
them
thank
bigger.
You guys. Appreciate it. What's that? Next day. Next up.
Retreat ends at 4:34.
Thank you.
Yeah.